Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And from Granite State College, offering diverse bachelor's and graduate business degree programs online. Designed to help working adults advance. Granite State College, where quality matters. More information and registration at granite.edu.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. A 100 years ago, the nation was in an uproar over the return of the draft. The U.S. had just joined World War I, and so in May of 1917, President Wilson signed the Selective Service Act, establishing a system to register young men for military service and assess their suitability for combat. It was quite controversial. There were protests, lots of people applied for exemptions or just didn't sign up, a situation that would return a half century later with Vietnam, when the draft system was widely criticized as grossly unfair. Since then, we've relied on an all-volunteer military force, although debate continues as to whether this is the right way to fight wars and defend a nation. Today in The Exchange, a chronology of conscription. And let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have two guests with us. Ed Miller is here. He's an associate professor of history at Dartmouth College with a research specialty in the Vietnam War. And Ed Miller, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Great to be here.
Also with us, Kirk Dorsey. He's a professor of history at UNH. And Kirk, always nice to have you. Thank you so much.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, looking back at the history, guys, many listeners will remember the controversy over the Vietnam-era draft rules. But boy, when you look back, Kirk, over time, it's often been messy. How much is this idea of required military service been a national source of tension?
Well, there's an old tradition in the United States, even before it was the United States, of a colonial militia that all able-bodied men should be prepared to serve to defend the colony, going back to some of the earliest settlements. And so this idea that men should be willing to serve their society with their risking their lives is very important. But at the same time, there's this fear of the standing army that was at the core of the revolution, the fear of the British army in particular. So we don't want to have a large army, but we also need to have men who can serve in times of crisis. And I think that's the tradition that the draft has tried to reconcile. At times we think there's a crisis, we better have an army ready, or there is a crisis, as in 1917, we better get manpower ready, but we don't want to have a standing army in peacetime that could be a threat to our liberty.
Well, and again, you know, most people remember all the arguments, Ed, about who got exemptions, student deferments, and all that stuff from Vietnam, but looking back, it's never been really done in a way that satisfies everybody.
That's right. When I look at the history of the draft, the first thing you notice is that drafts in American history are very atypical, very abnormal. We've only really had four drafts in U.S. history: the Civil War, World War I, World War II, and then the Vietnam era draft, or really what you might call the Cold War era draft, because it lasted from 1948 to 1973. But at all other times in American history, there hasn't been military conscription. And I agree very much with what Kirk said about this tradition of suspicion of large armies, and specifically standing armies, right? The idea that the United States should not maintain a permanent military force. At the same time, it has this sort of ready reserve of civilians, and the valorization of volunteerism that comes with that is kind of the flip side of the suspicion of conscripted armies.
Well, picking up on what both of you said about this sort of inherent distrust of having a large standing army, what about the sort of American character of, you know, independent, don't tread on me, government, don't tell me what to do. What do you think, Ed? How much does that play into our sort of national difficulty with drafts?
I think it's part of our national DNA. If you go back to the American Revolution and you look at the Declaration of Independence, the suspicion of the British and the British Army as an occupying force, as a force that quartered soldiers in people's homes, this is a very deeply ingrained suspicion. And I think you see this all the way through the history of the episodes of conscription that we've had, especially in the 20th century, that even when the government has made the argument that we need to have a draft in these times of national emergency, there's always pushback. There's always suspicion from both sides of the political spectrum, from the left as well as from the right.
Go ahead, Kirk. Yeah.
I would also add that besides our national DNA, we also have our national geography to thank for it, because for most of American history, there simply wasn't an existential threat where we needed to have a standing army ready to defend our nation against what? The small British garrison in Canada, against an invasion from Mexico. So there weren't really the threats needed to generate an army. So the United States was blessed with its geography as well as its ideology in that case.
The phone number for you to join us as we look at the history of the draft here in this country, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We're looking at a chronology of conscription in this country, but a little bit later, we'll definitely look at the question that keeps coming up in our country as to whether we should return to a draft or stick with our all-volunteer military. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. So this is really interesting. I'm geeking out a little bit on this. But, Ed, George Washington kind of had a hard time because, again, you had the suspicion of a big standing army. You had these little militias who really wanted to defend New Hampshire or Virginia, but maybe weren't that interested in joining forces in a national army. So how did our founding father and that general of the Revolutionary War manage this?
Well, you're absolutely right that from the beginning, this is another characteristic of the way in which the United States has raised armies, is it has often had a very strong local and especially state government component. And so George Washington essentially had to rely on these local militia forces and the state militias to supply him with the troops he needed. And, of course, this was a chronic problem for him throughout the Revolution. It's been argued that in the end, the most important troops were the forces that came from France. That's what allowed him to win the Battle of Yorktown, which turned out to be the decisive battle of the Revolutionary War. And I think especially people who grew up in New England, but really all over the country, know the legend of the Minutemen, of these volunteer, local, hardy New Englanders who were ready at a minute's notice to fight. But the implication of that is that they're living on their farms in their local communities, that they're not regular members of a permanent professional army force.
So they're defending maybe their own community, but not necessarily jumping in with both feet to this national cause.
That's right.
Here's how one expert described this situation that, you know, poor George Washington faced. This is from the American History Teacher's Book of Lists. A regular army is raised by offering cash bonuses and promises of free Western land. The system, however, does not attract enough men, and enlistments often run out before battles are over. General Washington is forced to call on state militias made up of poorly trained and led citizens who often leave at inopportune times to return home and tend their farms. Again, this is a quote from the American History Teacher's Book of Lists. What a mess, Kirk Dorsey.
Yeah, and actually I just had a student write a paper about the New Hampshire line in the Battle of Bunker Hill, and he showed this particular group of 41 men who came down and how many of them left either during the Battle of Bunker Hill or right after it, even though the newly forming Continental Army was trying to hold on to these guys, thinking they were in a long-term battle. They figured they had done their part. They came down from New Hampshire. They were there at Breed's Hill. They did their part. We're going home.
Wow.
They didn't see this as a long ideological struggle. They had been called up to serve, but they also had service back home. They had to take care of their farms and their families. And so the argument that he made, working with some other people's work, was that really what it was a lot of second sons who were not likely to inherit the farm or inherit the shop, but they weren't poor, but they also were young and they had needed something to do, so they went off and joined the army, but they didn't view the army as something they were going to stay in until the end of the Revolution. They were in and out depending on their family circumstances in many cases.
And we forget how long the American Revolution was, too. It was a long war, 7 years, I think, right?
And even in the War of 1812, I mean, there's a famous incident where the first American invasion of Canada stops because the New England militia won't cross the border into Canada because their job is to defend their states and they're in the United States, but they're not going to actually invade something, another place. So the regular army goes across and gets shot up and the militia is staying behind saying, we didn't sign up to invade Canada. We signed up to guard Northern New England from external foes. And that, which also raises the whole point about Northern New England in the War of 1812 and loyalists in the Revolution. You've got a lot of people in the country who are not crazy about these wars. And if you're conscripting them into the army, you're getting people who are very low, have very low motivation to be there, which is an inherent problem in running an army. If you have to compel people to serve, not only that compel them by drafting them, but also telling them what they're fighting for when they don't believe it, you've got a serious problem with discipline in the army in that case.
Well, the more you look into it, the more you realize how amazing it is that George Washington was actually able to pull this off. So he becomes president. As president, he tries to set up a military service registry that would include training, by the way. So Jefferson tries it, Adams tries it, Madison tries it. They all try it. They all fail, Ed. How come?
Well, I think it goes back to this suspicion of standing armies. During the early Republic, the federal government was constantly facing suspicion from many quarters about its attempts to increase the power of the federal government at the expense of the states. So at the state and local level, there was always pushback to almost any federal program, but certainly with regards to military forces and the attempt to raise military forces, the U.S. government had to deal with a lot of local rebellions during its early years of existence. The most famous of these is the Whiskey Rebellion, which George Washington is involved in putting down. So I think it's very much rooted in these local and state concerns. And this has really long-term implications for the draft even in the 20th century. This is why draft boards under the selective service system that set up in the 20th century remain these very much these local institutions. So we have the selective service system is a national institution, but it operates at a state and local level. And I think this is very much a legacy of the way in which armies have been raised going back to the founding of the Republic.
So it's not just a convenience factor that it's more convenient for you to go to, you know, your state capital and sign up or whatever. This comes from this history of states' rights and state control?
That's right. The way the selective service system works is that the boards are appointed locally. They're often appointed by governors of states. So the states and local communities are very much enlisted in this process of conscription.
That's really interesting. I thought it was just a matter of convenience. Go ahead, Kirk.
I would also add for the early republic, it's a matter of money. The federal government is bankrupt. And at one point in the 1790s, the biggest line item in the budget is paying off the Barbary states. So they don't have a lot of money, and a military structure is going to cost somebody some money that they don't have. They can't even pay for the Navy to fight the Barbary states in most cases. So, and they like the Navy. They can handle a standing Navy because it protects commerce and shows the American flag. So if they can't get the money for the Navy, they're certainly not going to find the money for a standing army.
So there's the idea that, you know, we may face threats internally, rebellions and so forth, but we don't face a big external enemy at this point in time, although you do have the War of 1812. Mm-hmm. So let's not bother paying for it.
Right. Well, let's not. How are we going to raise the taxes to pay for it is right. The problem. And the Revolution left a huge legacy of debt that they were struggling to pay off, and the states were in debt, and so handing this off to the states was not going to be an answer. And many of the states also, there had been resistance to the Constitution, so you already have people who are reluctant to have this larger federal government. Now you're talking about imposing some sort of military structure from the central government of Philadelphia. That's just not, it wasn't going to go over very well.
I think that's a really good point. Drafts are expensive, and paying for drafts is something that needs to be taken into account, even when we talk about contemporary policy. In the case of the early republic, there's actually a pretty strong sense of threat, I think, throughout the late 18th and the early 19th century. The United States leaders are very worried about France and Britain and the possibility of invasion, which, of course, does come to pass in 1812. And before that, Napoleon had been intriguing in Louisiana. So there's a very strong sense that despite the geographic remove of the United States from Europe, that these wars in Europe might still spill over. So the perceived need for military forces there. The problem is figuring out how to mobilize the public support and how to pay for it.
Real interesting. Well, let's go to our listeners, gentlemen, and then we can talk a lot more, including how drafts and conscription were handled in the Civil War by the North and the South, and then, of course, World War I and World War II Vietnam. Let's hear from you. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. We're looking at the history of the draft in this country, given that 100 years ago, right around this time, President Wilson signed the Selective Service Act, establishing a system to register young men for military service. Since Vietnam, we have had, as everybody knows, an all-volunteer military system. But there is ongoing debate over whether that is the best way to do it. Let's get your thoughts, 1-800-892-6477. And Michael joins us from Maine. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, my thought was if the sons and daughters of U.S. senators and U.S. congressmen that were subject to the draft, would we be so quick to go to war?
So the idea that there's not a lot of investment, I've heard this a lot when this issue comes up, Kirk, the idea that such a small percentage of Americans serve, and it's often said, hey, if the sons and daughters of members of Congress had to serve, maybe we'd go so quickly to war. Thank you for the call, Michael.
I think this is the most compelling current argument that people are making in terms of reinstating the draft, is that if there was a larger cross-section of the American people serving in the Army, we'd be less likely to end up in long wars in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, or name the next crisis, Syria, North Korea, whatever it would be. That it, and not only that, the senators would be more reluctant to vote in appropriations, but also that the average voters would pay more attention because they would have more skin in the game. I don't know. I mean, this is, I think, as much an anti-war statement as it is a real statement about bringing back the draft. So it's I don't know that it's a serious argument for bringing back a draft so much as it is making a point that the volunteer army has taken the burden off a lot of people. And the reality is that many senators either have had military experience or they have children who have served in the military. I mean,
less
and less. But you think Joe Biden, whose son was in the military, and John McCain, who was in many years. And so there is plenty of service experience. But I think the point is well made that one of the problems with the draft is it's evadable, and people with connections can evade it if they know how to do it.
Well, and we'll talk about all the loopholes over the years. But the broader point that Michael and many people raise then, Kirk, is, look, if more people had skin in the game, we wouldn't get in the game so much.
Right. And you can argue that. But at the same time, we got into Korea and Vietnam when we had, in effect, universal military training, when all young men pretty much had to serve. And we still got into wars of choice. I mean, we didn't have to be in Korea or Vietnam. And they both were very costly wars in terms of manpower.
Ed?
I think your last point, Kirk, is a really important one. I'm entirely sympathetic with the impulse behind Michael's statement here. But I'm not persuaded that the historical evidence actually shows that if leaders have military experience themselves or if they have family members who have served, that it makes them less likely to go to war. In the case of the Vietnam War, which many historians would say is the worst foreign policy disaster in American history, almost all of the leaders who made the decisions to lead the United States into Vietnam had served in World War II in some capacity. So I'm not persuaded that military service or having family members who serve in the military necessarily inoculates leaders against making bad decisions regarding use of force.
Thank you again for the call, Michael. We'll take more of your calls in just a moment. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. We're looking at the history of the draft in this country and, as Michael raised, current issues that come up around the debate as to whether we should move back to a draft from the all-volunteer military system that we have now. Coming up, we'll look more closely at Vietnam. We'll also touch on World War I and World War II, again, given that we're right in the period of the 100th anniversary of President Wilson signing an act that brought back the draft. So all that's coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
on the latest Outside In podcast.
I started convulsing or spasming on the ground, and I couldn't even sit up.
What if you could get rescued from anywhere on the planet?
You know, it's like, we're gonna die. Nope, we're gonna make it.
But what happens when not everyone gets the same chance to be saved?
The difficulty obviously rises when affluence gives one person a better chance of survival than another person.
Download Outside In on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, a chronology of conscription, a history of the draft. America's last experience with the draft was in the Vietnam War. Here's coverage of a peace march that includes the draft in Central Park in March of 1967.
Anti-war demonstrators protest U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War in mass marches, rallies, and demonstrations. Central Park is the starting point for the parade to the UN building. The estimated 125,000 Manhattan marchers include students, housewives, beatnik poets, doctors, businessmen, teachers, priests, and nuns. Makeup and costumes were bizarre. Before the parade, mass draft card burning was urged. Demonstrators claimed 200 cards were burned, but no accurate count could be determined.
Again, that's a clip from a peace march in Central Park against the Vietnam War and draft in March of 1967. And today in The Exchange, it's a chronology of conscription and today's views about the draft. What do you think? Should the military revive the draft or stick to volunteers? The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So, gentlemen, we talked earlier about how a lot of listeners will probably remember some of those protests and or have heard about them from their parents or grandparents. But it was controversial 100 years ago, too, with World War One. And I'll turn to you first, I think, Ed. Just remind us, World War One, America takes a long time to get involved. Finally, the president says, OK, we need to have a draft. Everybody needs to jump in. But everybody doesn't jump in, do they?
That's right. The World War One intervention was relatively short in scale and time compared to World War Two. When Wilson first took the country into war, he actually hoped that volunteer forces would be sufficient. He was actually worried about the domestic political backlash against a draft, including within his own party. He was very afraid that the conservative agrarian wing of the Democratic Party would resist calls for conscription. He also was facing a challenge from critics who wanted him to go in a sort of more extreme direction. And Theodore Roosevelt and others had been calling for something that would later go under the name of universal military training, the idea that all able-bodied males would be trained and then would be subject to activation as needed. In the end, Wilson decided to go with the selective service system. And the selective part of that is extremely important. The idea was that you would register millions and millions of American men, but then draft boards would be very selective in who they took. And so right from the beginning, therefore, the system is not trying to establish universal military training. The idea is that some men will be taken for military service, but others will not be.
So you are, all of you are registered, all young men, but then a few, or not a few, but a select number are selected for combat, and the rest are said you can go home or you have an office job, or it's sort of that sorting out process.
That's right. There were five classifications, five classes. Those in class one were the ones who were marked to be selected first for the draft all the way down to class five. And there were different rules for assigning people to different classes of the draft. And one way you could get a deferment, which would put you in a lower class, was if you were deemed to be working in an industry or an occupation that was somehow critical to the war effort. So there were these occupational deferments. There were also what were called dependency deferments. So if you were a father or a husband and you had one or more dependents, a wife or children or both, then that would increase the likelihood that you would get a deferment, that your classification would be lower, and then you would therefore be less likely to be called to military service.
Wow, so lots of quick marriages there, I'm guessing.
Well, that became a problem. By early 1918, there was talk in the U.S. media of a marriage epidemic, and and officials became very concerned to try to figure out when exactly did you get married? And this was one form of draft avoidance that became apparent in World War I.
Well, this has been a big issue. Again, if you look back over time, Kirk, you know, exemptions, who really gets pulled from this pool and who does not. During the Civil War, you could pay somebody to fight for you.
Right. And the Civil War starts with basically the small standing army that gets split between North and South. And then in the North, for instance, Abraham Lincoln calls for 90-day volunteers. That was an optimistic assessment of how long this war would last. And when the 90 days was up and they all went home because they had experienced things like Bull Run and the deprivation of army life, the North realized it was going to need to have a widespread collection of manpower to fight this war. It was going to be a long war that they weren't going to get enough volunteers, even with a relatively large number of volunteers. And they had to have these people come in on terms to fight the war. They couldn't come in on 90-day enlistments or temporary enlistments. But as with every draft, the question is who gets exempt and why? And so in this particular case, the idea that people who were wealthy enough to pay for a replacement could hire somebody who was not normally exposed to the draft, which at one point seemed like a logical idea to protect the people who were most important. But obviously, there's a huge backlash against it.
Oh, sure. You hear that today and your jaw drops, you know.
Right. And every war has these sorts of exemptions. So are you exempt because you have a particularly technical job? Or are you exempt because you are caring for somebody? Or are you exempt because you're in college and in the long run you're going to contribute more to the nation that way? So the draft is political, and so people are always trying to figure out, well, who should be drafted and why. And there's also a debate, for instance, before World War I about the ways in which war destroys the cream of the crop. So there's a pacifist named David Starr Jordan who's very persuasive in the early 20th century that war is a mistake because it's the best men who go off to fight and they get killed and then you're left with the riffraff running the country. And actually, this is what's happening in Britain in this time. The British volunteers, as Britain does not have conscription until late 1916. They've got what they've considered the cream of the crop showing up and getting slaughtered. And then Britain realizes, well, you know, we sort of have sent off our best sons, as Britain would see it, and to get killed in the mud of France. That was kind of a mistake. We should make sure it's a broader service and not just the people who volunteer.
Well, you really get into those some political issues, some sort of cultural and social commentary about like who's more needed and who isn't and who has more potential. Yes. And who doesn't. I mean, there's a lot of really sketchy judgment calls there.
Absolutely.
Let's go back to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Mike's in Sunapee. Hi, Mike. You're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, you're welcome. Good morning.
Morning.
I just want to make a comment and ask your experts to give their opinions. I was of draft age in the late 60s, and I volunteered. And when I reported to leave at the MEP station, it was a real zoo. It was very entertaining to see the extremes that some guys were going through to get out of the draft. And now, you know, here we are, 47 years later, 48 years later, I meet all these guys in my age bracket, and I wish I had gone, and I couldn't go. They turned me down. Where I am very suspect that a lot of these guys were draft dodgers, and they were amongst the ones who were carrying on and performing antics at the MEP station.
What kind of antics, Mike?
Well, guys would come in. They had obviously been up drinking all night. They would come in, and they would fake that they had some type of a mental disorder. They would come in, and back then cross-dressing wasn't acceptable. They would do that. They would do just about anything. I think if people looked at the demographic records from that period, a lot of 18- and 19-year-olds became fathers because you could get a deferment if you had a child.
Yeah.
So, there was every loophole, and every loophole was exploited. So I'm just kind of curious what your experts have to say on that.
Well, and Mike, you did go to Vietnam then, it sounds like.
Negative, ma'am. I did not go to Vietnam. I was lucky. I got trained to worry about the Soviet threat.
Okay. Well, that's enough to worry about as well. Well, thank you very much for the call, Mike. And, you know, Ed, this is your area of expertise. He's right. Exemptions were especially just a really tough emotional issue during Vietnam. People really feeling passionately on both sides of this.
Absolutely. And the avoidance of the draft, historians often distinguish between outright resistance to the draft and acts such as burning a draft card, as we heard about earlier this morning, versus avoidance, finding some way to avoid serving in the military. For some Americans, this might be a distinction without a difference, but I think it's useful to sort of categorize the different courses that Americans took. As historians actually have looked at who served in Vietnam and who did not, the historian Christian Appy has argued that the Vietnam War for the United States was a working class war. And he finds that overwhelmingly the enlisted ranks in Vietnam were made up of poor and working class Americans. And I think that speaks to the fact that it was by and large much easier for middle class and wealthy Americans to avoid the war. If you could show up at an induction center with a letter from your family physician saying that you had a trick knee or you had asthma or something like that, more often than not, that would be sufficient to get you classified at a level where you were not likely to be called, whereas poor and working class Americans were less likely to have those means open to them.
College deferments, that was done. And today we look at it and we go, wow, that's also sounds kind of unfair.
That's right. And that was built into the system. That was part of the selective part of selective service going back to World War I and World War II. The idea that those Americans who were getting higher education were going to contribute to the war effort through the advanced educational expertise that they were requiring. And that was an explicit provision of the system. And it's affirmed when the draft is reinstated in 1948. Louis Hershey, the head of the Selective Service System, says we are going to have deferments, especially for those Americans who are studying in college and graduate school, and especially for those who are studying science and other fields with military applications. So that's built into the system. But then during Vietnam, it becomes a huge source of tension. It becomes a real source of class and antagonism and resentment.
How do your students today, Ed, view this, that if they had been born, you know, several decades earlier, they would have been eligible for a deferment?
Well, I think my students who study the Vietnam War, I think they appreciate sort of the moral issues that are involved in this. I think that my students today, like many Americans, they very much admire those of their fellow citizens who serve in the military. I'm not sure that they know what they would have done in the case of the Vietnam War. After they take my Vietnam War class, I think they're quite critical of the war and of the decisions that got us into the war. So I'm not sure that they know what they would have done in that context.
Let's take another call. Thank you for that one, Mike. And Charles is in Concord. Welcome, Charles. You're on the air. Go ahead. Thanks.
Hi. Yeah, I think that the discussion has really moved to a really important point, which is what sort of volunteers do we want if we want to have a volunteer system? If it's going to be one that consistently will always enable those who have perhaps, you know, less income or come from a lower income background or be more poor against people who are more advantaged to either not need to volunteer, or if there is a draft, have all these different exemptions, then that is, it's not just unfair. I mean, it's a tremendous injustice. And so I guess I'd wonder, one, if we could really do, what would happen if there was some sort of blank slate to, or some sort of quick blank way to just kill off pretty much all exemptions, and what would be the ramifications of that? And then two, and I hope that this hasn't been touched upon earlier and I might have missed it, but what, you know, we can't be the only country in the Western world that's dealing with these problems. I know Israel has a very, you know, extreme take on the draft. And, you know, I really don't have any idea what, you know, a France, a Germany, or a Japan does to handle these problems. And maybe they just get involved in wars less, so it's not as big of a deal. But I'd be curious, you know, what our first world partners experience and how they handle the same problem.
Great questions, Charles. I really appreciate it. And to that first point, Kirk, can a nation really achieve a draft that's equal and fair? Because looking back at our history, it doesn't look like we've done a very good job with it.
Well, I think the intent is always to come up with a draft that balances the needs of the military versus the needs of society as a whole and who's going to contribute to the war efforts. It doesn't really make sense to draft all the people who are really skilled at building airplanes and make them infantrymen. So at some point, you got to have exemptions if you're going to have it, especially now with a technical army in a technical military. You need to have the people who can build and control the high technology pieces. So there have to be some exemptions there. At the same time, you do, in fact, have people at home who have dependents who need them to provide support, particularly in the era before the expansion of the safety net, first with the New Deal and then with the Great Society. You know, in the era of the Civil War and the First World War, there were people who had only one male dependent who could take care of, who could earn the money to take care of them, whether they were sick or whether they had children. So the idea of an exemption is not inherently bad. The question is, how does the exemption system get gamed by people with resources?
Like our earlier callers.
Right. And yeah, it's not just that you might be able to have the doctor with the trick knee. That's someone who writes about a trick knee. But maybe you pull connections and you get into the Air National Guard defending, you know, a Midwestern state rather than be sent in as a private in the Marine Corps or private in the Army to Vietnam. So you have the connections that you can also use because maybe you know whoever's in charge of the local National Guard. So I think he's right that that it would be good to start with a blank slate, but what would happen inevitably is we would have a reasonable discussion about who should get an exemption, and then people would figure out a way to get into those exempt categories, and the people with more resources would have the ability to sort it out. So I think it's very difficult to come up with a draft that truly treats everybody fairly in that sense.
So you can set up a system on paper that looks, you know, equal and fair, but then people figure out a way to make it less equal or less fair.
And I think the problem with these exemptions, of course, is particularly in an unpopular war, is they create really a corrosive effect in society. And I think that, you know, the caller who said, who he resented, I mean, sort of he was giving an Alice's Restaurant story, right? I mean, the people here trying to say whatever they could to get out of the draft. And then years later, he's looking at them saying, you know, you guys say you wanted to fight, but you didn't. And, you know, my colleague who teaches Russian history, Kathy Frierson, said this: the same thing happened in the Soviet Union with the war in Afghanistan, that war was so corrosive, people worked harder than ever to get out of the Russian military. But what that did was it corroded any faith in the system because the people with connections could get out. And I think that happens in countries with drafts in unpopular wars. People do what they can to save their sons from serving and possibly dying for a cause that they don't think is worth it. But then what it does is it sort of unravels the civil contract that we stand up to fight for our nation and we think that the laws are fair and just. It's just a corrosive effect.
Mm. Go ahead, Ed.
You're not going to get away from exemptions if you're going to have a draft. Just looking at the numbers involved, according to the Census Bureau, there are about 4 million Americans who will turn 18 years old this year. And the current size of the U.S. military, its active personnel, active forces, is about 1.4 million. And then there are about 800,000 more in the reserve. So you're looking at a total military force of about 2.2 million. And if we've got 4 million 18-year-olds this year.
Males.
No, that's male and female.
Do females have to register for the draft?
Females do not have to register for the draft. But if we're doing this thought experiment where we're implementing a draft in 2017, presumably women would also be subject to this, right? Because women now serve in the military. This is one of the big changes since Vietnam. So you could limit it just to men, then you would have about 2 million. But even that, just that 1 year's cohort is almost as big as the entire military is now. And the Pentagon doesn't need that kind of manpower. The U.S. military, even though it's still the second largest in the world in terms of manpower, is far smaller than it was during the height of the Cold War and much, much smaller than it was during World War II.
So why is it that all those 2 million boys who turn 18 this year still have to register, even though there's no draft?
Well, I think that's a legacy of the desire to keep the selective service system going, right? That's something that's happened since 1917. After World War I and World War II, there was this decision made, okay, we're going to stop the draft, but we're going to keep the selective service system going just in case we need to renew it.
All right. A little bit more to pick up on after a short break. We don't have a draft, but we sort of still have this registry, so we'll find out a little bit more. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Ever since the Vietnam War, America's had an all-volunteer military. But there's a long history of strong debate over the draft and whether it should be reinstated. We're getting a chronology of conscription today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you, your questions, comments, and personal experiences like some of our listeners have shared are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guests are Kirk Dorsey. He's a professor of history at UNH, and Ed Miller, an associate professor of history at Dartmouth with a research specialty in the Vietnam War. And gentlemen, before we go back to the break, we were just saying that even though we don't have a draft per se right now, we have this all-volunteer military, Kirk, some parents of teenagers may be surprised to know that your sons still have to give their names when they turn 18, but your daughters do not.
Yes, so the Selective Service, even though the draft was ended in the early 1970s, Selective Service still went on. In fact, in the early 80s, they basically made everybody register once again. It was a Cold War statement as much as anything. Again, they didn't need the manpower, but it was a statement of readiness. And actually, to turn back briefly to the previous caller, he asked about other First World countries. Sweden recently reinstated the draft as a message to Russia that they were preparing Sweden, that they weren't going to be caught off guard. So sometimes a draft is a statement to foreign countries as well. So the draft right now is purely gender-based. Young men, 18, have to register. They're available to draft, but the chances that we're ever going to have a draft, it seems to me, are pretty close to zero. And I think if anything—
Close to zero. That's a big statement.
I don't think there's going to be a draft in any time in my lifetime. I don't think there's any point to it. The military, we don't need millions of grunts, which is what happens with draftees. They get in the Army in a short enough time period that they become infantrymen. That's not what the Army needs a lot of anymore. And it's expensive, too. I think mainly we haven't gotten rid of Selective Service because it would be a pretty huge debate to say, okay, let's get rid of Selective Service. It would open up in a can of worms. Right now, Selective Service, the budget for Selective Service is like a rounding error in the federal budget. So it's not like we're going to save a lot of money if we get rid of it. So I think more, if anything, it's almost a legacy of the Cold War as much as anything.
So another can of worms, Ed, is, again, given how hard women in the military have fought for acceptance, to be allowed on the front lines, to be allowed to do the same jobs as men, has this also been part of their argument, that if 18-year-old men have to sign up, 18-year-old women should have to sign up, too, to at least have their names in the pot, so to speak?
I think the discussion's been out there. I understand that recently there were some rumors circulating on the internet that 18-year-old women did have to sign up for Selective Service, and it turns out that this is not true. It will be interesting to see if there is a change in that. I agree with Kirk that Selective Service today in the United States has only symbolic significance. Certainly, the Defense Department, the military, is not pressing for a draft. This is not something that meets their needs. Since the end of the Cold War, in particular, the U.S. military has tried to do more with less, or I guess I should say more with fewer, with many fewer soldiers. So they don't have the manpower needs that a draft would supply. It will be interesting, though, insofar as the Selective Service registration is a largely symbolic gesture, if now that women are not only serving in the military in numbers, but also now serving in combat roles, whether or not this registration requirement will be extended to them.
Well, it's interesting because this is a generation of young people keenly aware of discrimination based on whether you're male or female. Really a generation that has pushed for not only equality, but also don't put me in a gender box per se. So I'm just surprised that it hasn't come up.
Yes, it's very interesting. It would be interesting to know what leaders of the Pentagon think about this, whether or not this is something they even want to touch. My guess is that many of them would not, because, again, the draft is not something they're interested in. That's not a debate they want to have.
Let's take another call. This is Wade in Hillsboro. Hi, Wade. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you, Laura. I have 2 points. One is that if you have a draft, you offer politicians an enormous supply of manpower, and they're all too apt to use it. In my own case, I was in college between 1965 and 1970, and I worked as a draft counselor and saw a lot. We know now that Lyndon Johnson, his administration, did not want to draft middle-class kids like me because their parents are the ones who are politically active, and when their sons are taken, as opposed to working-class kids, the middle-class parents are apt to basically raise political hell and kick the administration out. The other point, the other half of that was that after every war, we have a lot of information about what actually went on behind the scenes, the political decisions. And we know now that President Johnson, like Nixon, made telephone tapes. And there are tapes of Johnson and talking to Robert McNamara and saying, well, this is a bad thing, we should get out of it, but we can't right now, and we can't win it, and we'll probably lose it. And we know that now, and we know an awful lot of other things about how the decisions were made.
Yeah, some of those behind-the-scenes decisions about who gets to stay, who gets to go, that we look at now, and we're like, wow, how did anybody come to the conclusion that that was okay? Love to hear from both of you. Go ahead, Ed, you first.
I think Wade raises some really important points about the history of the draft during the Vietnam War era. First of all, the sort of use it or lose it impulse, this idea that if the United States has a large standing army, if it has forces available, it's only a matter of time before U.S. leaders will deploy those forces into a war somewhere and probably an unnecessary war. That's basically the core of the argument against having large standing armies. So I think he's touched on something very important there with a long tradition in U.S. political discourse. He also raises the important historical point that the Kennedy and Johnson administrations really did shift the draft right around the time that the Vietnam War was escalating in the mid-1960s. Robert McNamara implemented something called Project 100,000, which was a deliberate attempt to lower the standards, the military's own standards, so that they could induct more poor and working class Americans who had previously been screened out of the draft.
Because they'd had criminal backgrounds or health problems, or what was the sort of lowering of the standards
in many
there.
Cases, it was because they didn't meet certain standards on aptitude tests or things like that, or maybe they hadn't met minimal educational standards, that kind of thing.
So it was a concern they might not be able to follow instructions.
That's right. And this this led to a shift in the composition of draftees and the class identity of the U.S. military. During the 1950s, during the first part of the Cold War draft, a total of about 70% of draft-age American men ended up serving in the military. During the 60s, during the time of Vietnam, that figure fell considerably to about 40%. And so there was more avoidance, but at the same time, the avoidance was undertaken more by middle and upper class Americans than by poor and working class Americans.
Well, Wade, it's good to hear from you. And it's interesting, Kirk, you know, we had an earlier caller who said, look, if we had a draft, you know, the sons and daughters of, you know, high level people like senators and congressmen would have to go and the American public would be more invested. So we'd have fewer wars. That's an argument that you hear a lot. But then Wade raises the other argument that is, if we had this draft and an easy way to raise large armies, then we would more easily jump into wars. So people kind of view this both ways.
Right. And that's, the draft is a political issue. What you'll make of it what you will in peacetime when you're trying to make an argument. If you look at the United States in the period in which it had universal military training and the highest percentage in the late 1950s, there was no desire. The United States had gotten out of the Korean War and there was absolutely no desire to go to war. And Eisenhower had no desire to send American troops into combat, even though he had this large pool. But then, volunteer army in 2003, we chose to go to war with Iraq. So there is a case where we, you know, you could, I think you could play it both ways.
You can find an example for everything.
And you can look in the history of any country with, almost all countries in the industrialized world have some sort of service, if it's not military service. So I had a graduate student a few years ago from Turkey who had to go back to do his 3 months of, you know, universal military training. And he was just in with a bunch of conscripts. And here he was, a guy almost with a PhD. But it was just part of the law. And I, you know, a guy in Norway I stayed with when I was traveling there who had a choice between serving his country in various ways and chose to join the Norwegian army. So there's, you know, in the 50s and 60s, there was, in effect, universal military training in Western Europe, and those countries didn't choose to go to war. So I don't think having a large body of soldiers inherently makes the country likely to go to war. I think that you still have to, there has to be a cause that you can rally some people behind. And it works the other way, too. Woodrow Wilson got a huge vote for war in Congress, but then had trouble raising the troops to go to war. World War II, which was the most popular war in American history, they still ended up drafting 10 of the 16 million people who fought and who served in World War II. There were still far more conscriptees than there were volunteers.
Really?
Despite
I didn't know that.
That war. So, you know, the draft, it can play out in various ways. I don't think inherently having a big army makes the country likely to go to war.
That's interesting, because the image of World War II is that, you know, people were so upset about what was happening with Nazi Germany and so forth that everybody jumped in.
Well, they jumped in for about a week after Pearl Harbor, a few weeks after Pearl Harbor. And there are some stories of, you know, incredible sacrifices people made to join. But then that fervor wears off pretty quickly. And also the army and the military can only take in so many at first. So it takes in a number of people, and then, you know, the army's trying to grow rapidly. They don't have the manpower. They don't have the NCOs to train people. And the fervor wears off, and then, you know, do you really need to join? And let somebody else take it, and then the draft is in place, so you don't have to make that decision. You go in any case.
It does seem that the takeaway from the overall history of the American experience with conscription is that the presence or absence of a draft really doesn't seem to incline the leadership either to get into wars or to avoid them. That we have plenty of examples of wars when there hasn't been conscript armies and vice versa.
And yet it's an argument that's made repeatedly that having an army will cause you to go to war. I mean, the famous line in 1940 when FDR pushed for a selective service was one of his opponents said it was the New Deal foreign policy to plow under every fourth American boy, making a reference to the AAA plowing under American crops to raise the prices. And FDR was furious that he was being accused of plowing under every fourth American boy by one of his opponents. So the argument was, if we have an army, we're going to use it. So that argument is very old, and it's an argument against having a peacetime draft.
Wow. All right. Well, Wade, thank you so much. And Steve's in Nottingham. Hi, Steve. You're on the exchange. Go ahead. Steve, you're on the exchange. Welcome.
I'm going to go a little different. I'm going to go with what you're talking about in Europe. What I propose is universal government service for everyone, men and women, at the end of high school. They can go into the military, or they can go into the CCC or Urban Job Corps. But they give back to the country for a year, like in Israel, they give back for men 2.5 years, women 2 years. But then, after they've served their country, they're given to their country, they then go to college. Now, as a college professor, I can tell you that the military veterans that I have are much better students and much more focused on why they're in college than many of the, quote, undergraduates.
Well, Steve, thank you. Yeah, and I have heard many other people make this proposal, actually, you know, doing a lot of reading yesterday on the pros and cons of reviving the draft and so forth. Kirk, a lot of people say, okay, doesn't have to be military service, but
correct,
something.
And having a fair number of 18-year-old boys and men in my class, at times I think maybe a couple of years of service of some kind.
Well, girls too, right?
I mean, right. Well, but I do think there are developmental differences. I think we're much more prone to see 18-year-old men who are simply or maybe not quite ready for college, and a couple of years of doing something else would have helped. But, you know, that's by no means even a majority. So I certainly am sympathetic to the idea. At the same time, the idea of sort of guaranteed national service, you have to do it, strikes me as running a little bit against the ethos of the country that we're going to make people do it. So I'm sympathetic to the idea. I think it's a great idea frequently for 18-year-olds to go do something before they jump. If they're not 100% sure what they're going to do in college, taking a couple of years off is a good idea. But I have enough of a libertarian streak. I'm not convinced that compelling all 18-year-olds to do it is a good idea.
Well, and if people want to, they do have that
absolutely
option through, you know, AmeriCorps and Peace Corps and other options like that. But making everybody do it would be a budget item, Yes. Yeah?
It would, in addition to being controversial, to have a mandate where all Americans were required to do this would be very expensive. I share Kirk and Steve's sympathy for the idea of service. And I also have a lot of 18 and 19-year-olds in my classes who I think could benefit from service. I also have some military veterans in my classes. And by and large, they're great students. So I really appreciate the value of service for young people. But once you start to mandate it, and again, we're talking about millions of young Americans, about 4 million a year. That's a lot of Americans to require service from. And how are you going to set that up? How are you going to enforce that? Are they going to live at home while they're doing their service? If not, who's going to pay for them to live somewhere else? What if they have children already of their own, which many 18, 19, 20-year-olds do? What if their income is important to their families? So we're back to this issue of requirements and deferments and exemptions. It's a very difficult, fraught issue.
Well, and Steve, I appreciate the point because it does come up a lot in this. Kirk, I want to return to something you said earlier. You said there is almost zero chance that we'll see a draft.
Yes.
I find that a very bold statement.
The Pentagon doesn't need it. The problem with draftees is almost always draftees are in for short terms. They don't draft them for 4 years. So the amount of time it takes to train them to do the technical things that the military needs, by and large, it's a long time to train them, and then they're gone. And so the military doesn't want them. There's not really a constituency of 18-year-olds clamoring to be drafted. The 18-year-olds who want to get in the military already go ahead and do it. There aren't a lot of parents who want to see a draft where their kids won't have a choice. So I don't really see a constituency in the draft. I think by far the strongest voices that are pro-draft right now are like the earlier caller said, if we had a draft, we wouldn't go to war. And I don't think...
History shows that's not true.
That's not true. Plus, I don't think we're going to push a draft to keep us out of war. There are better ways to keep us out of war.
Well, and you mentioned something we didn't talk about, which is, you know, today's military does require a high level of technical skill and training. And, you know, people who jump in with the draft just wouldn't have a chance to do that. Lots more we could have talked about, gentlemen. This has been really interesting. Thank you very much for being here, Ed, and I appreciate you making the trip down from Hanover. Thank you.
Certainly, my pleasure.
Ed Miller, he's an associate professor of history at Dartmouth College with a research specialty in the Vietnam War. Kirk Dorsey, always nice to have you on the air. Thank you
always
so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Laura.
Kirk Dorsey, he's a professor of history at UNH. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our interns are Alana Pearson and Edie Allard. Thanks today to our volunteer, Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.